You know the nightmare you sometimes have where, even though you're an adult now, and it's been decades since you were last in high school, you find yourself back in class, about to discuss a book you didn't even remember being assigned? That nightmare is about to become true.
Welcome to Sophomore Lit, where we revisit your 10th grade reading list. These are the books that were required reading for English, the books you read once and maybe never thought about again, or they might have stayed with you. Were these books any good? What were these books all about? Join us as we reread the dog-eared paperbacks plucked from the hall locker of your memory. This is John McCoy, your host, and for this inaugural episode, I have with me someone that you may be familiar with, my little brother Dan. So say hello, Dan, and tell us something about yourself.
Hello. I'm not sure why that you didn't say why they might know me. Maybe I shouldn't say that.
You should say that, yes.
I have my own podcast called The Flop House, and in my day job, I'm a writer for The Daily Show. But you probably, if you listen to podcasts, you know me from that first thing. And I didn't realize this was the inaugural episode. You're making the key mistake of having the person with the closest voice to you on the first episode.
Well, this all started when my good friend and fellow podcaster, John Syracusa, said that he didn't believe that you and I were separate people, so now he can listen and enjoy hearing our exactly the same voices in stereo. So, anyway, this is a show about those books we read back in high school. And, Dan, you and I went to the same high school. We went to Eureka High School in Eureka, Illinois. And... Right. I don't know. I read the Lord of the Flies. I read it in a class as part of a preparatory exercise in
going on a survival expedition,
which seems like a very bad idea considering what happens in the book.
Yeah, okay, this is good. I was going to ask you whether you had read it as part of that, because I believe that's where I read it too. And it was the class when I took it was called Man and His Materials. Was that the same?
It was called American Cultural Studies back when I was in... Okay. I'm sure it's exactly the same class.
Yeah, there was a survival encounter as part of it, which, yeah, it seems strange that the... I guess there are lessons to be learned from it, but they're all in the negative.
No, I don't think that... You know, when we went on our survival encounter, we went to a local farm where we all camped out in the untilled section of the farm at night, and some people caught grasshoppers and ate them, and that was about as hardcore as we got. I don't know if you have any stories.
Ours sounds actually a little more complex. There was a whole scenario that was, I mean, it wasn't much of a scenario. Like, the idea was we were on a bus that broke down, so that was the full scenario, but it was off in the woods near a ravine somewhere. And I remember building an A-frame shelter and weaving leaves into a thatch for ourselves to sleep under.
The book we did read this week is Lord of the Flies by William Golding. It was published first in 1954, and it's really the only book that anyone remembers by William Golding today. He was, I learned, a member of the Royal Navy during World War II. He commanded a landing ship during D-Day. And I think that, like a lot of post-war English authors, this book reflects the obsession people had with the nature of evil and what made people do bad things. Did they cover any of this in the class, or did they just have you read this cold?
I don't know whether they went into any of the history. I went and I checked. My deep research was to, of course, check the Wikipedia page. And in it, someone had written that this was a dystopian novel and that the action of Lord of the Flies was taking place during some sort of unspecified nuclear war. And I have no notion where they got that idea from, because I don't think that that's in the text anyway. I always just assumed that this was supposed to have taken place during the Second World War.
I actually read the book first, strangely enough, when I was about 8 or 10, because our older brother, Robert, had read it, and he was really keen on it, and he shoved it into my face and said, here, read this book. And I read it, and I didn't really understand much about it, but I never quite figured out what the scenario was supposed to be that got these kids to the island. We can talk about that when we go over the plot, but it is very fuzzy what exactly brings these kids to the island, and I was thinking about it and thinking, if this is written in the early 50s, there wouldn't be any missiles yet, there would be bombers, but would the reaction to a war be to get all the kids onto planes and fly them halfway around the world from the UK? I don't understand.
Yeah, that's true. Is it some sort of mass evacuation? And if so, it seems very inefficient.
Well, anyway, this book was not a overnight sensation. It was actually rejected by the first 21 editors, Wikipedia says. And the first edition didn't sell much. But eventually, it became a favorite for literature survey classes in both college and then nowadays mostly in high school. I think what happened was the hippies and beatniks took over the classrooms and wanted to make the kids feel bad about man's inhumanity to man. The other thing that I found kind of fascinating, because I'm a wonk about these things, is that this book is actually a commentary in some ways on a Victorian novel called The Coral Island by Ballantyne. Did you read about this? No, yeah. There was a Scottish Victorian novelist who wrote about three boys who got shipwrecked on a South Seas island, and their names were Jack, Ralph, and Peterkin. And so the characters of Ralph, Jack, and Piggy are considered sort of new versions of these characters. And that story was all about these kids creating a new civilization on these islands and helping to Christianize the natives. So in some ways, this book is kind of a reflection on colonialism. But I don't think that gets taught in most high schools these days.
No, that I can't say that that necessarily enriches my understanding of the book in any way, but it is interesting as trivia.
Well, there is a scene at the very end of the book, jumping ahead, when the boys get rescued, the naval officer says, it's just like the Coral Island. So it's made a kind of as an explicit reference, I suppose, that the readers in 1954, especially British readers, would know what the hell he was talking about, but right. No one else does. So do you want to go through the plot of this book?
Sure, let's, although I'll let you take lead.
Sure, okay. Well, you know, it's as we mentioned, it did start with these kids crash landing. For some unspecified reason, a plane load of British schoolboys, apparently like 8 to 12, it's not clear there, have crash landed on what seems to be a South Pacific island, but who the hell knows? It could be off the coast of Africa, would make more sense, closer to Britain, but I think it was done that way because he just desperately wanted to get them onto an island.
Right, and wherever it is, it's a small enough island that they can circumnavigate it easily and sort of figure out everything that exists on this island.
Right.
So it that kind of plays into it being not well-known, the rescue not being assured.
Okay, so we are first introduced to our hero, whose name is Ralph. He's staggering out of the woods as though he's just crash landed. You know, it's sort of like it's like these characters are emerging from Golding's fevered imagination. You know, this happens a lot in the book. People just show up and things happen, and there's not a lot of explanation for why they do or how they do.
Yeah, I don't know. This may well be a technical term that I'm misusing, but the book seems pretty imagistic in that. It, as you say, there's much that is fuzzy and much that, you know, you get an idea of what's going on, but you have to kind of parse it out and interpret what's happening.
Right, and I think the hand-waving is kind of important for what's going on here, because the more you try to think about any reasonable scenario that would get these kids there, the less sense it makes, you know. It's kind of the Lost problem. Lost starts with a plane crash, too, but the sad fact, and I apologize to anyone who's listening to this while you're on a plane, is that if a plane falls out of the sky, everybody's on that plane is going to die. There's no two ways about it. They're all dead. But for some reason, all the kids on this plane have survived and none of the adults have survived. And Jack wanders out of the woods and he runs into a kid named Piggy, whose real name we never learn.
Ralph wanders out.
Ralph, yes.
With his choir boys. Right. All of these boys seem to have come directly from school.
Exactly.
In their uniforms and everything.
Well, it's nice that they had, you know, in the midst of an evacuation, the kids could, you know, get suited up. I suppose they were going to stop in on their way, you know, down to, you know, the Isle of Wight and just, you know, give one last concert before they left the UK altogether. So Ralph runs into this kid, Piggy, and they talk a little bit about their predicament. Piggy is fat, is his characteristic, and he's smart, we're told. Ralph is quiet and contemplative, and he finds, dun-dun-dun, a conch shell, which becomes one of the major images of this book. In the absence of a lot of stuff on this island, there are these key objects, the conch shell. Later, when we meet Jack, he has a knife, Piggy's glasses, there's a pig's head on a stick. There are all these things that become these central symbols to the book that endless numbers of poor sophomores have to write, theme papers explaining what each of these symbols means. Any observations here? Because Jack does show up.
Yeah, I have no particular observations other than I think that when reading this book at first, part of my dislike for it came from the fact that I was all too sympathetic with Piggy as a kid who was perhaps smarter at school things than at being able to relate to my fellow children, and chubbier and with glasses and such that, the whole course of the book is just Piggy being ignored, humiliated, and ultimately killed.
Yeah. He's not treated well by anyone in this book, and his eventual fate is treated more for horror than it is for sympathy, I think. What happens is Piggy suggests to Ralph that he blow the conch, which is not really the way that conchs work. If you've ever held a conch shell, and you'd actually have to hollow it out before you could get any kind of tone from one of those things.
Yeah, I think you had one, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I had one.
Growing
Go
up,
ahead.
I don't remember you ever being able to get a sound out of it or anything.
No.
Or at least not a significant one.
No. But somehow they blow this conch, and kids start popping out of the jungle left and right, little kids first, and then we have Jack and the choir boys appearing. And this is, you know, a thing that Golding does a lot, is he first describes them as these shimmering shapes or these animalistic figures, you know, and I know that he's trying to set up eventually, you know, that this is going to be the force of evil on the island, but it just doesn't seem like any experience I've ever had. You know, it seems like he keeps expecting that you're going to just go along with people mistaking other people for animals or mistaking dead bodies for monsters or whatever, and that happens here with Jack, and Jack, we know, is evil because he has red hair and he's leading the choir boys.
That seems so British for that to be the indicator.
Yes.
I had no idea that anyone had anything against redheads until that famous YouTube diatribe against about being a ginger.
The other thing that happens is that when Jack shows up, all the kids have like this little, they have this little powwow on the beach, and they decide to elect a leader. And it's revealed that Jack has a knife. And it's another one of these things that is, I think, a central image to the book is Jack's knife, but there's no explanation for it. It's called a sheath knife when they first describe it. The one thing I've noticed about reading this book is it's one of those books where you read two or three pages, and then suddenly you say, wait, what the hell? And you go back and you read like three pages back to try and find out who's talking, or what's happening, because it's not, nothing is made very clear. And Golding has this habit of having everyone talk in one or two word sentences and having four people talking at once. So that all leads to a kind of a dreamlike state, but it's not always a state that anything's clear. So I guess Jack has salvaged this from the plane or something, because we don't know where the hell he's got this knife from, but it becomes a very important point in the book.
Yeah, although the other thing, too, with his knife is that other than Piggy's glasses, which are used to make fire, it seems like so obviously the most useful tool that they have, but I mean, maybe this is because Jack is the guy who does not care about survivalism, who only wants to hunt, but so little is actually made of it as a useful tool for these kids.
It's also the only man-made thing around, aside from the glasses, I suppose, for those of you writing your term papers right now. You can use that and make sure you cite me. They spend a long time going around the island. They want to establish this is an island. And Ralph chooses Jack and another character named Simon, who is a quiet, sensitive kid who will become sort of thematically important as they go along. And he completely blows Piggy off. They actually climb a mountain to be able to get a vantage point where they can see things. And they see the kids down on the beach. They see a rock off in the distance on one side of the island. And that becomes, of course, one of the major scenes in the book, is this rock does. But one of the things that struck me as I was trying to figure this island out is this island feels like, you know, when you're a kid and you would draw a treasure map. And you would have like, okay, now here's the hangman's tree here, and here's the one mountain on this island here, and here's the jagged cliffs here, and none of it makes any geographical sense at all, but you just want to have each of those little points there for your little adventures.
Yeah, no, it's true. I don't necessarily walk away from this book having a real sense of how this island operates, like what kind of island this is. Apparently it has a beach, and it has some brush, and it has an area, a wooded area, and one mountain, and a strip of rocks going out to kind of a cave rock, and that's about all I know about it. And it's not, those things don't necessarily not go with one another, but at the same time, it doesn't give you a great idea of what sort of island this is.
They find the tracks of pigs. Jack makes a feint like he's going to stab a pig. He doesn't do that. And then this is kind of one of those weird moments. Is when they finally get back to camp, it isn't clear to me how much time has passed, but they talk about the little kids are all afraid of a beast they say they saw in the night. And I don't know whether that means that these guys have been gone for a day checking out the island, whether that means that there's already been a day here that the kids were here on the island. I think that Golding is trying to, you know, stir his little thematic pot. There is this kind of lack of clarity about the timeline of events.
No, I find the kids to be so stupid throughout this book, and I understand that that's part of the point, and perhaps not untrue to children, but I also find it frustrating as a reader beyond what I think is supposed to be thematically there. And some of it is in the whole beast thing. I don't necessarily think that the story needed to have a external threat that they believe existed to make the point that it wants to make.
Well, that's an interesting point. I think we should touch on this when we actually get to the whole sort of Lord of the Flies segment, because there's sort of an odd metaphysics to this book, which is he is trying to make some sort of a statement about the innate nature of people to turn on each other or to become barbarous, but it's not clear whether he's saying that is just a psychological thing, whether there's some sort of a metaphysical way in which there actually is a force of evil in this world. I don't know. And the beast is sort of an externalization of that. It also seems like, again, with this book, it's trying very hard. It's pushing those symbols really, really hard. So Jack goes off on a big hunt. He runs into some wild boar. And while he and his guys are off hunting, they let the fire go out. In the early meeting on the beach, they had all agreed they were going to keep a fire going on top of the mountain so that anyone looking for them would find them. And they do believe, from a plume of smoke they see in the horizon, that there might be a ship out there. And there's a big, big recriminatory argument between the boys on the beach about the importance of keeping the fire going versus the importance of hunting for food. This is the first of maybe, I don't know, 12, 13 of these arguments that happen throughout the book. Mm-hmm. It just seems like for the rest of the book, that's all that anyone talks about is the fire and the pigs. Somewhere in here, there is the appearance of a dead fighter pilot. And this is another one of those scenes, I think, where Golding, you know, is trying to talk all obliquely and confusingly about what's happening. Apparently, there had been some sort of a dogfight up between, you know, because whatever's happening in this war, there still are apparently plane-to-plane conflicts, and a dead fighter pilot has been ejected from his plane and happens to land on the island. And I have to give it to him. I think this is actually some pretty creepy writing when he describes the body coming down, and especially it being kind of caught there, and the parachute blowing in the breeze and kind of jostling this body about. I don't know if you found that effective or just confusing.
It was effective and confusing. I didn't mind the obliqueness then, but then I also kind of felt like there was a lack of clarity. As it remained oblique, when the boys see this dead body and the parachute later on, and become convinced that this is the beast, it sort of beggared my belief that they would think that. I mean, certainly the shifting parachute from far away could be a creepy large figure in the distance, but then there's all this talk of like how they see the monster and it has teeth and it has all these things, and I don't know. I guess that's true to the kind of rising paranoia that might be felt, but at the same time, again, I just ended up being frustrated with the stupidity of the characters sort of beyond what Golding intends.
Right. So somewhere after like five or six arguments about what's going on, Jack and his hunters do succeed in killing a pig. And in another one of these sequences that maybe thematically is very strong, but just makes no sense, he cuts off this pig's head in what it seems like about 5 minutes work with a knife. I doubt you would get very far into a pig
Speaking of someone who cooks a lot and has butchered things, yeah, there's no way that a child would get through a pig's head. But sure, we'll take it for the story.
Right. So he announces that they're going to stick this head up onto a stake because this will appease the beast. Now, by this point, they have sighted this dead fighter pilot, have identified it as a beast, and so Jack comes up with this, what would you call it, a ritual. It's supposed to kind of underscore the way in which he and the other kids are becoming more and more savage in a look-at-those-primitives sort of way. it does come up with the, he does come up with the phrase of sharpening a stick on both ends, which becomes a another mantra through the end of the book about people sharpening sticks on both ends as a oblique threat, and it's a pretty good piece of writing.
No, I liked that as it went on, and because when it became a threat to Ralph, the power of it came from the fact that Ralph had no idea what the hell that was supposed
to mean. Right,
so it creeped him out without specifically knowing why a stick sharpening a bow's edge would be a bad thing.
Jack takes his band of hunters off to that rock that we saw earlier in the book that they call Castle Rock. It becomes their little fort, and it seems like nearly everybody has on the island has gone there by the end of the book. Who's left on the other side of the island are Ralph and Piggy and Simon. And in the kind of the one scene that everybody who's read the book remembers, Simon comes across the pig's head.
What are you doing out here all alone? Aren't you afraid of me? Simon shook. There isn't anyone to help you, only me, and I'm the beast. Simon's mouth labored, brought forth audible words. Pig's head on a stick? Fancy thinking the beast was something you can hunt and kill, said the head. For a moment or two, the forest and all the other dimly appreciated places echoed with the parody of laughter. You knew, didn't you? I'm part of you. Close, close, close. I'm the reason why it's a no-go? Why things are what they are? The laughter shivered again.
So, what do you think? I mean, I have to give it up to Golding. It's a legitimately creepy scene. But one of the things that always kind of bothered me about this scene was when I read this book first as the age of 8 or 10 or whatever, I just took that scene on face value. I did think that there was some malevolent force of evil that was talking to Simon and that Simon was the only one who could hear it at that point. And now that I'm older, I understand that Golding probably meant it to be seen as some sort of a hallucinatory psychological thing, and I don't like it as much somehow. I don't know why.
One thing that I found interesting in doing, again, limited research about this book, the interpretation is that, you know, Simon is possibly epileptic, and, you know, I was epileptic growing up, although not of the sorts that, where I had spells that would, you know, make me fall down. It was more of just visual, like, field of lights in front of me, and I would have spells like that. But that he's this sort of mystic figure because of that, and possibly a religious one, and so that he can see more deeply into what's going on than the rest of them. I don't know if that makes me like it anymore. It's interesting. It's a, you know, I mean, they do split these characters into kind of very representative individual, you know, like they do have Piggy as the ineffective intellectual and Ralph as the thoughtful leader and Jack as the, you know, more bestial leader, and then this mystic character. And so within the context of these characters being very specifically representative of different types of people, you know, him having this insight makes sense. And it's an effective piece of writing, as you say. I don't know how I feel about it, I guess.
Well, it certainly has inspired, I think, a lot of bad deviant art. But and it's a scene that I think lots of high schoolers like to write on.
And, you know, you brought up Castle Rock before, and paperback, the cheap paperback that I bought for the purposes of doing this podcast had quotes from on the back. The first quote was from Suzanne Collins of The Hunger Games, and then the second quote was Stephen King. And it's interesting that you know, neither of these are literary authors, so they're not trying to bolster the literary reputation of this. But the thing is, I feel like I would enjoy this book a lot more if it was just pitched to me as a simple horror tale. And obviously, you know, it was influential on Stephen King, who set, you know, he has this fictional town of Castle Rock, right. But also in general, you know, seems to be interested in these stories of kids and, you know, children interacting and dealing with horror.
Right.
And, but his is much more explicit supernatural horror. And maybe that would have been just more
I fun. Do recommend anyone who is interested in the crazy, meandering, forced hipster speak of Stephen King writing essays. if you look on the Faber and Faber site for Lord of the Flies, they have the introduction that he wrote for the, I guess, 30th anniversary edition of this book. And it is just typical bonkers Stephen King, like him talking about growing up in Maine and going to like the bookmobile. And he said, he says that he asked the librarian, "Give me a book about the way kids really are." And I was thinking to myself, however kids really are, they don't ask librarians for books about the way kids really are. Anyway, but yes, it's interesting that this has been such a influence on people like King. And then, you know, Rob Reiner named his production company after that for doing Stand By Me.
Stand By Me.
So anyway, speaking of Castle Rock, Jack and his crew are up there, and after Simon has this vision with the pig, he faints, he awakens in the night, and he sees the dead body of the pilot for what it really is. And he decides he's going to go tell everyone, and he comes down to where Jack is having a sort of a wild sort of Dionysian something on the beach in front of Castle Rock. And this is where, again, Golding has to have this happen to make his point, but it makes absolutely no sense. Simon comes out of the jungle and they mistake him for the beast and kill him. And it's described like he comes out shambling and apparently disheveled, and he may have thrown up on himself when he saw this pig's head or whatever. But I do not for a minute believe that you're going to be confused about a person coming out of the jungle. I mean, I think it would have been stronger to say that they were so in the thralls of their bloodlust.
Well, there's some of that. They're whipped into this frenzy. It's, you know, it's a primitive dance, and they're, you know, miming the hunt. And then Simon comes out, and he becomes kind of a victim of that frenzy. But in so much as then the story does seem to suggest that they legitimately mistook him for the beast, that just doesn't work.
And then he goes floating out to sea with the tide, just as the pilot gets blown free from his being tangled, and he's blown out to sea. So there's a lot of parallel action going on. Now there's only left Ralph, Piggy, and these twins we haven't mentioned before because they're completely uninteresting, named Sam and Eric. And that seems to be the only thing that they exist for, is to be sort of a running joke about, oh, twins, you can't tell them apart. Is it Sam? Is it Eric?
And to be referred to as a unit.
Right, Sam and Eric.
Sam and Eric.
Jack and his hunters invade the original camp to steal Piggy's glasses. We haven't gone over this, but Piggy's glasses are, again, one of these huge symbols in the story because they're used to make fire. And early on, when Jack comes back from hunting, he gets angry at Piggy and hits him in the face and breaks one of the lenses. And that's also supposed to be symbolic of, I don't know, something. And so the theft of these glasses is seen as sort of the triumph of barbarism over knowledge, I guess. But it also means that Piggy really can't see. So this sets everything up for sort of the the final conflict of the book. Piggy and Ralph and Sam and Eric are going to go to Castle Rock to try and get the glasses back.
And to make their last sort of pitch for civilized society.
Right, they bring along the conch. Is it Piggy brings along the conch? I don't remember.
I believe so, because I feel like he's the character who still believes in the power of the conch, you know, much past the point where any sensible person would be like, oh, no one's paying attention to this shell.
The conch is, of course, the symbol of society, of polite society, of polite discourse. And again, I must have tried to reread this sequence two or three times, because it's sort of unclear to me just what's happening from a stage direction's point of view, because Ralph confronts Jack, so he's apparently on top of the rock. Piggy is apparently below them, because there is this one character. What is his name? There's this one British character who...
Roger.
There's this one who's sort of the heavy for Jack, who's throwing rocks, and he apparently one of these rocks hits Piggy, and at first it seems like he's just like flinging little rocks or something, the way it's described, but this rock that hits Piggy and kills him, you know, knocks him backwards, and he hits his head on the ground, and the conch shatters to 1,000 pieces. In another one of the highly symbolically charged scenes of the book, and Piggy also eventually ends up, I guess, washing out to sea. I mean, it's it all makes sense perfect sense from a thematic point of view. It's not clear to me exactly, you know, if you were going to stage this, you'd have to really make some strong choices about who's standing where and what's happening.
I had a similar problem later on when Ralph comes back to Castle Rock and tries to get Sam and Eric, and then escapes and is chased by everyone. And I really had no sense of where anyone was ever supposed to be in relationship to one another.
Right. I think that by the end of the book, the kind of fog of war that everyone kind of emerged from at the beginning of the book is kind of reasserting itself. Mm-hmm. As you say, Sam and Eric get taken into the Hunters. They're tortured and made to join the Hunters. And Ralph is the last great hunt for Jack and his guys, and they're being chased around the island. He runs through the clearing in the wood where the pig's head is still there. And there's like the head gets knocked off, and they talk about the mouth being open wide or something like that. I don't know. It all becomes kind of a mishmash at this point, until Jack, being chased out of the woods, comes out into the beach and runs right into a British naval officer, who is here to save everyone. And again, this is a thing that I think makes more sense if you see this book as a response to the Coral Island, in that it's about sort of, you know, at the end of the Coral Island, the three kids have spent their time on the island learning about how you create a new society, and now they're back, they're ready to go back and rejoin the British Empire, having conquered this part of the world for the Empire. And instead, you get this military figure showing up, and it's uncertain whether, you know, what the long-term effects are going to be for any of these kids who are survivors. And they go off to an uncertain world where, I guess, this war is still going on.
Yeah, I'll give Golding this in terms of... One of the things I like about the book is the abruptness of the ending, because it's just sort of like, well... Once that point has been made, like it just gets out, you know, like the society has been reasserted, not because of any great moral force, just because an adult shows up and all the kids immediately, you know, sort of shamefully revert back into being children.
Right.
And the officer doesn't quite understand what's been going on, you know, and how could he? But then the book just sort of ends, and that's kind of jarring in a good way, I feel like.
It is jarring in a good way, but it also has, I think, one of the most ham-fisted bits of writing. It really, really bugged me. You know, up till this time, Golding has been talking very obliquely, you know, and his writing is, you know, he uses a lot of, to use the literary term, synecdoche. He's very, like, when the officer shows up, the first thing he talks about is seeing the hat, you know, and so that's sort of what happens all the time, is you don't see the whole object, you see part of the object again and again, and nothing is spelled out. But then at the end, you have this moment where Ralph, like, breaks down and sobs, and he says, you know, that he says, Ralph wept for the end of innocence, the darkness of man's heart, and the fall through the air of the true wise friend called Piggy. And I was thinking to myself, bullshit! You treated Piggy like crap through the entire book. And, you know, and also, where the hell is this, like, innocence, end of childhood coming from? You know, it's like... you know, it's like Golding suddenly, I think, may felt like, geez, this book was pretty hard. You know, maybe I should make some sort of something to say that I have human feeling, because, I mean, it is a kind of a cruel book. But I thought that was like a real weird misstep at the very end of the book.
Yeah. Well, you know, you just got to sum it up for the people who maybe didn't get it, weren't paying attention. For all the confusing... He put in all that confusing oblique language, then he's like, okay, well, you know, just in case, here's this.
Okay, so, now we've gone through the book. Why this book? Why do you think this book gets taught in high school? I mean, it's kind of a rough book, you know, it doesn't really have a happy view of humanity, it doesn't end happily for any of the characters involved. Why do you think this book is so prevalent in high schools around the country?
I mean, I do kind of think that it might be because it is so easily interpreted. It is so, like, the symbolism is all right up front. The themes are all right up front. So it's a easy book to give to young readers to give them an idea of interpreting themes, and also, and it's all wrapped in the guise of, to some degree, a boy's adventure tale, even though it's really more of a horror story. Right. So that might be part of it. It is kind of a weird book in the sense to give to kids, in the sense that I don't feel like in high school teachers were often comfortable trying to make the point that people are really shitty. Like, that was more of maybe a college thing that would come out. So that's interesting, I guess.
No, I agree. I think that it is a book that is easy to interpret, and it's certainly a book that is easy to glom onto these symbols. When you're a young reader who's trying to tackle ambitious literature, that's kind of one of the doorways in, is to see things through the lens of allegory. And this is a book that is pretty straightforwardly an allegory. But, you know, I think that there's a danger here, which is young readers have quickly jump to allegory as their interpretive key for everything else that they do. And I don't necessarily think that they need any encouragement for that.
Yeah, and also, I mean, something that's much more expressly an allegory, or at least equally expressly an allegory, that, you know, is also a book I think that commonly taught in schools would be Animal Farm,
right.
Similar themes. And I don't know why I find that so much more interesting to read, but I think part of it is it has a lot of humor in it, like a mordant humor, but it's got some, and Lord of the Flies has none. And also, even though it's allegory, I feel like I believe those characters, those animal characters, on a level beyond the characters in this book. I don't know. I get mad at literature where I feel like I can feel the authorial hand sort of pushing its chess pieces into place.
Right.
There's that Iranian film, A Separation, which was beloved by many, but not really by me. I could see how it was a good movie, and all of those characters are much more three-dimensional and human than anyone in something like Lord of the Flies. But at the same time, I felt the point that the author was making, and I felt the pieces being pushed around the chessboard to get them into position to make that point. And it bothered me. It made me angry rather than drawing me in.
Sure. I think that with any book or movie or play where the theme is, boy, people are really awful to each other, you have to present people being awful to each other in a way that seems realistic and seems derived from those characters, because otherwise it's sort of like, people are awful. Let me tell you the story I just made up about people being awful. Therefore, people are awful.
I mean, it's a lot more interesting to me, honestly, to see things come to a bad end with everyone making good faith efforts to be good, you know? And also, like, I don't know whether this book was more shocking at the time, because perhaps there was more of an idea of the innocence of youth, but I was reading this sort of also thinking, like, I don't need a book to tell me that kids can be assholes. Like, I already know that kids are assholes. Kids are much worse than they're usually made out to be. And, you know, so what if this book shows that that's true?
Right. Well, again, as a post-war examination of why people do evil things, it sort of takes the point of view that people can do evil things when there is a charismatic bad actor. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, Jack is a cipher. He doesn't really have any reason for what he does other than perhaps a desire to assert power and authority over Ralph, who he thinks never should have been in a position of power.
And I can certainly believe that to a group of boys, you know, the hunting adventure aspect of being shipwrecked on an island is much more palatable than, you know, the idea that we have to build shelter and we have to maintain order and we have to maintain a fire. That makes sense. But then the next leap into, and then they start killing everyone, is the one that doesn't necessarily
right,
follow.
Right. Well, you know, this book has been taught to nearly everybody that I've talked to about this project of mine, of having a podcast about books we read in high school. Nearly everyone has mentioned this book. It does seem to be something that people remember. And I do think that they remember it because it was a nasty book. You know, especially when you think about other books that people read, like The Scarlet Letter or something like Catcher in the Rye, which I think is a much better book, but it might be harder to remember the incidents that happened in that book. I think everyone can remember a pig's head on a stick. Everyone can remember a kid getting smacked in the head with a rock and the conch cracking. I have to say that those things are powerful. You know, they now are something of a cliche. But it is interesting how deeply this this book has permeated popular culture. I mean, there was that Simpsons episode.
You know, I stuck with The Simpsons much longer than many, but that was a fairly late season episode, but that was one of the early indicators for me about how they stopped caring when they make a joke of it at the end, where they're like, and the kids were rescued by, let's say, Mo. I mean, and that's a funny joke, but at the same time, it sells out, you know, much of the honesty of earlier
Simpsons.
Sure,
sure. So, any last words? Has this book stuck with you in any way, or is it a book that you were happy to see the back of?
I was happy to see the back of in the way that this project brought back to me, like, this made me remember school in the sense that it made me remember resenting having to read a book that had been assigned to me when there were other books that I could be reading. But luckily, it's a very short yes. book. I finished it in 2 days worth of subway commutes, so that was fine. And I found myself liking it a little bit more as it went along. After the resentment faded, the second two-thirds of it, you know, picked up for me. I feel like I liked it again, though, much more as a horror tale than as anything else. Like, I don't feel like as literature I had much great shakes. I feel like this might as well just be, you know, The Twilight Zone, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, or something like that. But, you know, there was fun stuff to be had. But my original assessment when I was a kid was that I didn't much like it, and that stayed the same, revisiting it.
On that note, we'll end this week's podcast. If you'd like to leave a comment on this episode, or maybe suggest a book for a future episode, or just reminisce about your own sad high school experiences, please email me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com, or you can join the Facebook page and leave comments there. I'd like to thank my brother, Dan McCoy, whom you can visit on the web at flophousepodcast.com. I'd also like to thank Darren Husted for reading the passage from the book. Finally, I'd like to thank my high school teacher, Mr. Hululan, and all teachers everywhere for putting up with our nonsense. Lord of the Flies is copyright 1954 William Golding. For our next class, please read J.D. Salinger's A Catcher in the Rye. Remember, everything will be on the final.